Good afternoon, and welcome to the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Ron Yates. I'm the Dean of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois, and I'm here setting in for Celeste Quinn, who is away on vacation. Our guest today is Larry Berman, author of a truly fascinating book, Perfect Spy, The Incredible Double Life of Pham Xuan An, Time Magazine Reporter and Vietnamese Communist Agent. And that's a long and very complex title, but perhaps it's appropriate because Vietnam itself was a long and complex war. In fact, nothing in Vietnam was really what it seemed. It was a place of incredible intrigue and deception, a truly inscrutable land that could be at the same time surreal and perfectly routine. Larry, welcome to the Afternoon Magazine, and congratulations on writing such a compelling book.
Well, thank you, Ron. I appreciate that.
You know, I should explain that Larry Berman is a professor of political science at the University of California, Davis, and interim director of the University of California, Davis-Washington program, dividing his time between Washington and Davis. Larry, before we begin, I want to put on my journalist's hat here a little bit and provide some context and background for our discussion today. You know, context is always important, and it's especially important when we're discussing Vietnam. It may be difficult for some of our younger listeners to believe, given American involvement in Iraq today, but no event in recent history has had the impact on the United States as the war in Vietnam, which began in the early 1960s when President Kennedy sent in several thousand advisors and didn't really end officially until early in the morning of April 30th, 1975, when the last Americans fled Saigon during a chaotic evacuation. And, you know, Vietnam ripped this nation apart like no other event that I ever witnessed and has certainly changed some people forever. And those of us who worked in Vietnam as correspondents arrived with really little more than our preconceptions. Many of us left with a lot more, often very deeply personal, emotional baggage, horrific memories of suffering and anguish that we really can't forget. And as always, in the case of war and conflict, a few very fond recollections of people who and places and events that we don't ever want to forget. And of course, I think that's at the heart of Larry Berman's book about an amazing man named Pham Xuan An. Let me read just very quickly, Larry, a description of the book and a short biography of Pham Xuan An, and this is the subject of the book. And by the way, this can be found, this information can be found on Larry Berman's website, which is LarryBermanPerfectSpy.com. And let me read this. This is very, I think, very revealing, and it certainly says a lot about who this person was that we're going to be talking about today. During the Vietnam War, Time reporter Pham Xuan An befriended everyone who was anyone in Saigon, including American journalists such as David Halberstam and Neil Sheehan, the CIA's William Colby, and the legendary Colonel Edward Lansdale, not to mention the most influential members of the South Vietnamese government and army. None of them ever guessed that he was also providing strategic intelligence to Hanoi, smuggling invisible ink messages to the jungle inside egg rolls. His early reports were so accurate that General Giap joked, "We are now in the U.S. war room." For more than 20 years, An lived a dangerous lie, and no one knew it because he was a master of both jobs. After the war, An was named Hero of the People's Army and promoted to general, one of only two intelligence officers to ever achieve that rank. So, you know, Larry, I covered Vietnam for the Chicago Tribune in 1974 and 75, leaving on those last helicopters as Saigon fell to the communist North Vietnamese. And while I knew Pham Xuan An, I didn't know him well. I did have coffee with him and a few other correspondents a few times over at the Givral, which is a cafe directly across from Tudor Street from the Continental Palace Hotel where I lived. I think among those people that I might have sat down with on with was people like Bill Stewart and Jim Wilworth. But like a lot of reporters, I had no idea that he was a spy for North Vietnam. And so I guess my first question to you would be is how and when did you meet Pham Xuan An, and how did this book come about?
Yeah, that's a great way to start. And by the way, I wanted to say I've had the opportunity to read your articles in 1974 and 75 that you wrote from Vietnam. Your listeners may not know this, but they're first rate and right on. So it's a privilege for me to be talking with you as well. So,
well, thank you, Larry. That's very kind.
On that. I did not meet An until 2001, the summer of 2001, when I was in Saigon for actually the very first time. I was not in the war. I was then later. This is an important point, actually. One of the reasons An allowed me to write this book, I mean, why would a spy allow a professor to write a book like this, is because I had no associations with him whatsoever. and he had great respect for a previous book I had written on the Paris Peace Accords. And to make a long story very, very short here, I met on a dinner one night. I hardly had any recollection of who he was. I had recalled reading about a double agent, someone, a journalist who had fooled everyone during the war. But that night he and I talked about a lot of other things, primarily the time that he spent in California in 1957 to 1959, and all of his good friends. And what struck me as he was talking about his good friends, it just didn't include David Halberstam, Neil Sheehan, and Stanley Carno, and Francis Fitzgerald, who were journalists, but it included some of the top CIA people in our country's history, like William Colby and Edward Lansdale. And then it also included South Vietnamese politicians and generals. And I just, was intrigued by this. And it took me 3 years to convince him to allow me to write his life story. And I caught him it was towards the end of his life. He was very ill. I think he thought he only had a short period to live, but he hung on for 3 more years. And that enabled me to write the book.
Well, I'm glad he allowed this to happen, because it's such an amazing history. I mean, it's the story of this man, but at the same time, when you read it, and I really recommend that our readers get this book if they want to know something about Vietnam and the incredible dichotomies which existed in that country during this time, to pick up this book and read it, because it's going to tell you a lot about what was going through people's minds at the time, and certainly a lot about what it was like living in Vietnam, especially for an American. You know, I want to remind our listeners again that you're invited to join the discussion by calling 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana, or toll-free at 1-800-222-9455 from anywhere you can hear us on the radio, or anywhere across North America that you might be listening on the Internet. So those numbers again are 333-9455 or 333-WILL locally, and toll-free 1-800-222-9455 or 1-800-222-WILL. You made, Larry, I think you made about 15 trips to Vietnam for interviews with An and members of his espionage network while writing Perfect Spy. And what was the most surprising thing you learned as you conducted research for this book?
The most surprising thing I learned about An, and also probably about the war, was, of course, how much he truly, truly admired the American political system, believed in that the greatest place in the world to live was the United States of America, and that he just simply didn't believe that America had any business in this country. That is, that the war itself was something that should be settled between the Vietnamese. And I thought that historically that was a very, very important point. Maybe not all that surprising, but very, very, very significant, because it was these relationships that he forged which were so important. Now, the most interesting thing I discovered, and there were things I never got an answer to, but the most interesting question I had, and that was answered, was how do you survive for so long? That is, the communists had lots of agents, as you know, infiltrate virtually every level of South Vietnamese society, whether it was media, the government, the bureaucracy. As a matter of fact, probably the reason one of the reasons the outcome of the war was such was because the successful infiltration by the Viet Minh or Viet Cong or communists, whatever we want to call them, of every structure of South Vietnamese society. But most of the really high-level agents got caught or had to flee to the jungle, but An survived, and he just didn't survive in a sort of a secretive job. Here was a guy who every day, was out with reporters, hanging around with military commanders, South Vietnamese politicians, and I learned from An that, of course, the reason that he survived was that he took this job of journalism, and I hope we can discuss this, so seriously, and that he never once in anything he did slanted a story for Time magazine where his name appeared on the masthead for the entire time he was at Time magazine, and he was a vital contributor to so many stories for Time. He never once slanted a single report that he did for Time magazine or in anything he did with these reporters towards the communist perspective, because if he had done that, he would have been caught, he would have been outed. So he had lived his cover as if it were his real life. To me, this was fascinating because I thought when I went into this, I would find evidence of, here's an example of a guy who had infiltrated the media, he probably slanted stories towards the Viet Cong, the communist perspective, and that was his purpose. And he said to me one day, you know, my job was much too important. I was strategic intelligence. We had other people whose job it was to slant the news. So I had to be totally objective. I had to be a good journalist. And indeed, the journalists I spoke to, his bosses like Frank McCullough, Stanley Cloud, and I met, you mentioned Jim Wilworth a little while ago. He came to a talk of mine in Washington a short time ago. All of them agree that he did this job so objectively. So to me, that was the most interesting.
Well, and it's interesting because you point out in the book, of course, he mentions this. You mentioned this in the book, that he actually studied journalism in the United States in the late 50s, like 57 to 59 in Costa Mesa, I guess. And so he came to understand American journalism, at least, you know, the values of it and the way we pursue it and the way Americans, you know, practice journalism. And he took that back with him to Vietnam. And I think you're right. He practiced it the way he learned it and felt, I think, very proud of his journalistic background and certainly the work that he did for Time magazine. And he also worked for Reuters, I think, and also
Reuters, New York Herald Tribune, and the like. And, of course, the most interesting thing about his time in California, which I think is one of the more interesting parts of the book, is just think about this from the communist perspective. And I know there's a lot of listeners probably are too young to remember the fact that they only remember Vietnam as the big war, an American war. But in 1957, as it went on, was sent to the United States on a secret mission, which was to learn about the Americans to become a journalist, because that's how sure the communists were that one day America would invade them, because they had been seeing the amount of money that the United States and advisors that the United States were starting to send in following the defeat of the French in 1954 at the MBN Phu. An told me that when he was in California from 57 to 59 and then drove across the United States, interned at the United Nations, interned at the Sacramento Bee, and had all these wonderful experiences, he never thought that one day 550,000 American troops would be in his country and that, you know, there would be a Rolling Thunder 1 and Rolling Thunder 2 and defoliation and everything else. He thought that there would be something, but that eventually the Americans would understand that this was between the Vietnamese, and it became this horrible, destructive, terrible war, and that placed An in this really awkward position because he became a spy not knowing how bad it was going to get, and he had no way of getting out until the war was over, and he held on to this vision his entire life that when the war was over, the Americans and the Vietnamese could be friends again, because that's how it had begun. That's how it was for him from 57 to 59. And you need to be a psychiatrist to figure this out. But I mean, that's really the dream that he held.
Yeah. No, I know exactly what you're saying. We have a caller on line one from Champaign. Caller, go ahead with your question.
Several statements, questions. What's the name of the book?
The Perfect Spy.
Perfect Spy, okay.
The Perfect Spy, The Incredible Double Life of Pham Xuan An.
Okay. Now, it was my understanding that we had a commitment to Vietnam long before Kennedy, and I don't know if we had American troops.
I guess you can say it began with Truman.
Truman, okay. I don't know when American troops were original, right? And the French defeat at, what is the place?
The MBN Phu in 1954.
Okay, and Johnson certainly escalated it in
65.
Okay. Now, this is somewhat a field, but my impression, having been alive at the time, was that Kennedy was probably going to let Vietnam go. And that's the thrust of my question. And that's a little bit of field from your book, but yeah. I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
I've written on this in another book, but I mean, I think there are many people who think that Kennedy was going to let Vietnam go, and that was the theme of Oliver Stone's movie, JFK. But I think in reality he would have faced a very difficult political situation in his second term had he lived, which would have been 64 to 68, and faced a backlash of letting South Vietnam go down the drain to communism, something that three American presidents before him had said was worth fighting for. So I don't know if that would have happened, of course we'll never know.
No, we'll never know that. You know, in the book you say that an interesting statement, that An believed that the United States got in the way of Vietnamese history. And I know what you mean by that, I believe, but I'd like you to explain that to our listeners, because I think that's a really interesting comment that he made.
Yeah, well, it's There's a lot of other comments like that in the book, and it's a really important point, which has to do with the fact that all of Vietnam's history had to do with one thing, which was fighting foreign armies on their soil, whether or not the Vietnamese were fighting the Chinese, the Japanese, or the French, the Vietnamese were proud nationalists, and one of the things they believed in, as we all do, would be our country's right to self-determination. And Vietnamese long history was of fighting foreign armies in their land, and it was a really total lack, in my opinion, as I say in the book, a total lack of our understanding of Vietnamese culture, history, that led us into this sort of massive and terribly destructive the war that we now call the Vietnam War, but in Vietnam is called the American War. And I believe we got in the way of Vietnamese history because this was up to the Vietnamese to decide. It wasn't up to the Americans, who always had a better vision of their future. In the book, there's that other quote that An said to me. He said, the Americans always had a better future planned for us and so therefore they thought we should just go along. And, I'm not on the show today to talk about, examples of other American adventures, but in Iraq, a very good point could be made about sort of the similar patterns of thinking with respect to planning other countries' future.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, there are parallels, and it's also apples and oranges. I mean, obviously, Iraq is not Vietnam, but there are some parallels when it comes to
right.
policy.
And Saddam Hussein was not Ho Chi Minh, which is the biggest another big example.
Absolutely. When you go back and look at the history of Vietnam, and you study people like Ho Chi Minh, you realize he was an enormous ally during World War II, fighting against the Japanese, and of course that was all went all by the wayside after the war ended and 50s began. But I just want to say, our guest today is Larry Berman, author of the book Perfect Spy. If you have any questions you would like to ask Larry, you're invited to join our discussion by calling 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana or toll-free at 1-800-222-9455. From anywhere you can hear us on the radio or anywhere across North America that you might be listening on the Internet. Whenever people talk about Vietnam, Larry, inevitably one of the comments one hears is that the press lost the war in Vietnam because it was so critical of the way that the war was conducted. And I think given An's personal and professional connection to so many journalists, do you think that that Pham Swan An had a significant impact on the way journalists reported the war? For example, was he an agent of disinformation, for example, who significantly influenced these journalists' coverage of the war?
Yeah. It's a great question. In the book, I'm very clear that I reject the charge that has been made that An was an agent of disinformation. And an agent of disinformation would mean, in this case, someone who, like An, who was a communist agent whose job it was to shape the reporting of a David Halberstam or a Neil Sheehan or any of his close, or a Stanley Carno or Francis Fitzgerald or a Beverly Deep, whoever it was, to the communist perspective. I could find not only evidence, and I looked in everything in Time magazine, but of course, I went out to the University of Wisconsin, to the Wisconsin Historical Archives, which I think is the key to my argument that An was not a agent of disinformation, because there I went into the files of the New York correspondent, Far East correspondent, Robert Chaplin, who was a very close friend of An, but also kept verbatim notes and of all of his conversations with An from 1962, really, or 1963 right through 1975. And these are voluminous notes, handwritten and then retyped. Chaplin died quite a while ago, so these had been deposited there by the family. And when I went through those notes, I'm reading now, just so your listeners understand this, what I'm reading is Chaplin's notes of conversations with An, who is the sources. And basically, all one has to do is read The New Yorker from 1965 to 1975, and it is An speaking, because that's how much Chaplin relied on An. And you could find nothing in those notes, that is what An is telling Chaplin, that anyone could consider disinformation. Now, there's as a matter of fact, it's fairly accurate, very objective, and very astute with the level of sophistication that An is providing, and is very critical at times of the Viet Cong and communist strategy. For example, following the Tet Offensive, An is brutal in his assessment of Chaplin about how stupid this offensive was militarily, you know, and the devastating defeats that the communists had taken. Someone who was trying to slant Chaplin's reporting on that would have tried something entirely different. Now, there is a second issue to that, which is, of course, I think a lot of reporters were against the war, you know, and a lot of the reporters saw the war the same way An did, and that made it easy for An to talk to these people. And indeed, as the war went on in 1969 and 1970 and 71, most reporters who were showing up in country at that time, it was just a matter of time before they saw a different war than the illusion of progress that the administration was putting out. So I think the press pointed out contradictions in policy. They weren't responsible for the policy. That's just my own. You're a professor of journalism now. You can probably answer this better than I can. But that's my answer.
Well, you know, one of the things you were mentioning, and I think in the book you mentioned this a few times, some things that An did not want to talk about and didn't want to share with you in the writing of this book. I mean, just and intuitively, if you were looking back on interviews with An, is there anything that, I mean, do you have an idea of what he might have held back from you that he didn't want to be sharing with the general public? I mean, without going into great specifics here.
Well, I think there's a lot he didn't tell me, and as you know, in the book I acknowledge that. I mean, certainly he never acknowledged any of his sources, and he never really went into great detail on his modus. He discussed broadly his modus operandi as a spy, that is, how he got these strategic intelligence reports, how he would get him to the Coochie base and the like. But he never divulged to me his sources, which I would have liked to know, and he did not tell me things that I knew he had done. I had heard from other members of his network, for example, that, oh, you should ask An, you know, about his reports on the Strategic Hamlet program. And An never talked to me on his own about the Strategic Hamlet program. When I probed him, he was really he didn't want to go into it too much, and the reason for it was because the only way he could have gotten those documents were from some of his very close American friends, and clearly wanted to protect them as well. So he was always protecting someone until the end.
Hmm. Well, tell us, I mean, also, that what you kind of alluded to this, there were some interesting, I mean, the way he got this information out from Saigon to Coochie, which is, you know, not, it's a little ways from outside of Saigon, was interesting, and he did it with a courier. Could you kind of explain that and talk about the woman that he used to get this information out there?
Yeah. Well, the woman he used was her name is Winti Ba. She's still alive. She's in her middle 80s. I saw her recently in Vietnam. The way it would work was that during the day, An would pick up these documents. He would get documents given to him by usually the South Vietnamese, our ally, the South Vietnamese members of their an organization known as the CIO, the Central Intelligence Organization, or by our Military Assistance Command Vietnam, and he would be given these documents because An understood the Americans so well, and he also understood the Vietnamese, and he was always explaining things to people. And An would get these documents, and he would take them home, and that at night he and his wife would photograph them. He would write up these reports in invisible ink. They would wrap them in what we would call traditional Vietnamese rolls, which look like egg rolls. Then he and his dog would go to a public market, and he would meet Ba, Miss Ba, and they would strike up a conversation, and he would ask her to try one of these little rolls, and she would eat one, and then he would pass her the others, and they would say goodbye, and she would head off to Coochie, and he would go back to Time magazine. She did not know where he lived. She did not know his phone number. She did not even know how to contact him in an emergency, and she was illiterate. Yet for the entire period of the war, she was his sole intelligence courier, and all of the communication with respect to where they would meet next, etc., was actually prearranged. By another courier who would tell her where to be, at what time to be, and then she would be there.
Fascinating, fascinating. We have another caller on line one, Champaign County. Go ahead. You're on the line with Larry Berman.
Hi. I was curious about the analysis of Tet that he gave, because that's sort of pivotal in the people that say the media lost Vietnam, because they talk about how it was actually a tactical victory. But what it meant to me, I think this was even contemporaneous, but reinforced by thinking back on the time, the point that you made at the beginning of the show, that there how much sympathy there was for any kind of variant of we want the U.S. out, we support the North, or we support some kind of resistance. There was no way that Tet could have been pulled off unless there's thoroughgoing sympathy, even in Saigon at the time. So I think there was some kind of after-action report by the Pentagon that showed that 30% of the government, the South Vietnamese government, was actually in some form sympathetic to the resistance, to U.S. Presence. So that's what Tet meant to me. I don't know how you reacted at the time, but the idea that he was thought it was tactically a bad idea, if that's what he said, I wasn't quite sure.
Yeah. For your point's well taken about the 30%, but and actually we didn't go. There's another part of the Tet that's very important with respect to my book. Pham Xuan An received four special medals for his contributions to the Vietnamese victory against the Americans, and one of them was for his role as a strategic intelligence agent during the Tet Offensive. And what that meant is that prior to the Tet Offensive, several months before, the communists sent down, this is the first and only time they did it during the war, they sent An's direct supervisor, a man by the name of Tu Cang, C-A-N-G, into Saigon. An gave him an alias as a friend, a dog collector and a bird collector, and their mission for 4 months preceding Tet was to case out all the infiltration points in vulnerable areas in Saigon. And because An had a press pass, so was so liked by everyone, he had access to all these military installations and also knew where security was good and where security was weak. And it was on the basis of their report that the communists did choose certain areas for the infiltration and the like. Now, what Tet revealed, of course, was that Saigon, even though the attack was repulsed, the fact is that Saigon wasn't nearly as secure as the government was saying it was, and that even though the communists had failed to achieve their ultimate goal of uprisings around the whole country, this sort of image with 550,000 American troops already in country of a light at the end of the tunnel seemed very far away to a lot of people. And in truth, we were no closer to achieving our political objective in 1968 than we were in 1965. Now, the interesting thing about Pham Xuan An is, as I point out in Perfect Spy, here he had done all of this intelligence work prior to the Tet Offensive, but of course he's also working for time. And then the Tet Offensive happens, and what does he do? He actually has to go out. Everyone calls him. You know, Bob Chaplin calls him, Carnot calls him, Neil Sheehan calls him, and they all want to have this thing explained. And what better person to explain the offensive than the person who had planned it? And An takes them all over and shows them all how the communists got in. And he's actually taking them to the places where they've stashed their weapons and used as access points. And he's saying things like, well, they came in over here, they came in over here. And he was telling the truth, but he also planned it. So wow. It was really an amazing double life that he was
Well, and actually what he did was, and reading the book, is he actually brought in a Viet Cong or North, I don't know if it's Viet Cong or North Vietnamese officer, operative, right? Brought him into the city and showed him around the city, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
Amazing, really amazing. Thank you for your call, caller. You know, a couple of things, just a quick side note. I'm pretty sure, I cannot recall this for sure, I'm racking my brain here when I was looking at the book and looking at An's picture and everything, but I'm pretty sure he helped me find a Vietnamese interpreter while I was in Saigon in 75, and he had a woman get a hold of me. She was part Vietnamese, part French, part Indian, and I know she was really sympathetic to the Viet Cong, because she told me, you know, she was, and she didn't like the South Vietnamese government and was actually working, but she was like, you know, she was actually working to set up a meeting for me with some people in the National Liberation Front, at a farm that her family owned out south of Saigon, and that but that meeting never came about. But I know she talked to me, and what I'm hearing from her is what I'm hearing and reading from Ann, that she didn't. It wasn't that she hated Americans, and she this was her country. It was their problem to deal with. It was their civil war, and that she just wished that we had not come. And when it came time for the evacuation, I remember telling her, "Okay, we're going to be going to these different evacuation points, and you should meet me here, or bring your mother, or whatever, bring your family, and we'll get you on a chopper out." She didn't go. You know, she stayed, and then I couldn't quite figure out why. But you know, later on, I was able to figure it out.
Well, I'm glad you raised that because, of course, in my book, that's I think one of the most fascinating parts of Ann's life because Saigon is falling. And your listeners, I think, will find this interesting. Saigon is falling, and what does Ann do? Ann evacuates his family, his wife, and four children. Because don't forget, everyone thinks he works for Time magazine. And he evacuates his wife and family to the United States. They go to they go to California, Fort Pendleton. They're processed. They end up in Virginia, where they're going to live for over a year until Ann recalls them. And Ann thought he was going to be asked to go as well to continue his mission in the United States. But at the highest level of the Politburo, that was rejected. So Ann stayed behind with his mother while his family fled because Ann thought that the invading communist victorious army would kill his family and kill him as a friendly Vietnamese to the Americans. And he ends up hiding for days. And even when General Giap, the man who you began the show by saying, had once made the comment, thanks to Pham Xuan Am, we are now in the Americans' war room. Giap flies to Saigon for a great victory day, and Ann is hiding in the Continental Hotel in Bob Chaplin's room because he's afraid to walk on the street because people will kill him and kill his dogs. You know, I mean, it's a very scary time in his life.
It's really astounding. Now, I understand also, and I think at least there's one part of your book where you talk about on actually being responsible for getting a journalist released, who was captured by the Viet Cong.
Robert Sam Anson, that's correct.
Right. Were there others that he helped get released? I mean, do you know if he had anything to do with Kate Webb's release, for example, when she was captured in Cambodia by the North Vietnamese?
I asked him that. He said no, but he definitely saved the life of Robert Sam Anson, which is the opening chapter of my book. And I've spoken to Anson, and I gave a lot of attention to that case study because I think it's such a revealing one. Because as Ann said, he never betrayed any of his friends, and which is the other level of this story, which is that he valued his friends, he loved his American friends, he never betrayed a reporter, he said, and it's one of the reasons why, and I think this is one of the great mysteries of Ann's life, which is how is it that all of these reporters, all of them, with one or two exceptions, which are noted in the book, still consider Ann to be not only a great friend, but such an admirable person? That is, once news came out that he had been a spy for the enemy of this country during a war, how is it that so many friends still remained his friends? I would imagine in the field of journalism, if it had turned out that Ann, rather than being a communist spy, news had come out that he had actually all the time during the war been working for the CIA as a undercover narc for them, reporting on what people in the media were doing, I bet you all of those people would have rejected Ann, okay? Mm-hmm. But when it turned out he was merely a communist agent, it wasn't very offensive. And it was very interesting for me to deal with that in the book.
Because I really think that a lot of journalists who worked there for any length of time came to understand something about the Vietnamese people. I mean, not that we understood them very well, but some things we understood, and that was they were deeply nationalistic, and I don't think that means they were necessarily communists or communist sympathizers or whatever. But this was their country. They felt very strongly about it and what was happening to it. And I just see most journalists probably looked at Ann the same way. And look at him today the same way. This was a man who was passionate about his country, felt that we were intruding as the French had and as the Japanese had before them, and this was not something that that we needed to be doing. And I don't think it. You couch it in terms of politics. You couch it in terms of the way people feel about their country.
Right. Most reporters, and indeed a lot of Vietnamese today, see An as a fierce nationalist and not a communist. And as in my book, I have that quote from Germaine Locke Swanson. You may have known Dick Swanson during the war,
mm-hmm.
the Time photographer, Time Life photographer. His wife, Germaine, and their story is a great one about how he got her family out in April of 75. But Germaine, who knew An as a Vietnamese for years and years, said Pham Xuan An was a communist by obligation. He was a nationalist in his heart. And I think that really does explain who he was. And it all gets messed up with the politics of the war. And you're 100% right, because, you know, even today, liberals, conservatives still fight the war in the war in Vietnam. Oh, we could have won if only mm-hmm. the media had not turned the tide, or we could have won if we had a million men. We should have nuked them. But you know, the fact is that we had a very limited political objective, and you know, it was an extraordinary expenditure of resources that we put into Vietnam, and we were no closer to achieving our objective when we left than when we started. It was a very sad period.
It was. Our guest today is Larry Berman, author of the book Perfect Spy. If you have any questions you would like to ask Larry, you're invited to join our discussion by calling 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana, or toll-free at 1-800-222-9455 from anywhere you can hear us on the radio or across North America that you might be listening on the Internet. Those numbers, again, are 333-9455 or toll-free 1-800-222-9455. You know, one question we have to ask, I guess, is this, and I'm sure you've been asked it many times. Do you believe An's work as a spy resulted in the deaths of American soldiers?
Yes, and in the book I talk about the day I challenged An on that, because he, of course, said that he wasn't responsible for the deaths of anyone. And I believe that he was wrong there. He was just himself. He always likened himself to someone sitting in, you know, in Langley, an agent in Langley, or in the Defense Department, just writing up plans, and then it was up to other people to implement them. But you can't be known as the greatest spy the Vietnamese had during the war, which he is, and he is acknowledged as, and he is, you know, he's promoted to hero, made a general. You cannot have achieved that lofty status and not have the responsibility for not only the deaths of Americans, but many Vietnamese. And An and I argued about that several times, and he felt that I was wrong, but I ultimately, in my book, I say that I believe that he just was deceiving himself on that one.
You know, in the late 1990s, I had the opportunity to interview a woman, Dr. Dong Quyen Hoa, and she was one of the 16 founders of the National Liberation Front in 1960, which was a group that we'd come to know as the Viet Cong. And she told me she felt, this is 1995 when I went back for the 20th anniversary of the fall of Saigon, and she told me that she felt really betrayed by Hanoi after the fall of Saigon, that there have been, she said, too many mistakes. One mistake, she insisted, was that they began, you know, treating the people of of South Vietnam like losers and the people of the North as winners. And as a result, there were too many re-education camps, too much punishment, and not enough healing. And she said, I'm going to quote her, without the people of South Vietnam, Hanoi would never have won this war. It was not the forces of North Vietnam that won the war. It was the guerrillas and their supporters in the South. And I guess that raised a question in my mind. Do you think that Pham Xuan An was happy with what happened in the South after the North Vietnamese takeover, or do you think he might have shared some of Dr. Hoa's sentiments?
Oh, she paid a big price for sharing her sentiments. And again, the readers might find this interesting, but after the war, now we've been talking about what a great spy he was, promoted to hero, everything, et cetera, et cetera. But he was put under house arrest for 9 years. He was allowed no contact with any Westerners. He was sent away for 1 year to Hanoi for re-education, political re-education at an institute, because the members of the Politburo in the North believed that he had been tainted by his association with the Americans, that he had lived this cover for so long that he was actually too American, that he liked Americans. And because when the war ended, An was preaching reconciliation in 1976. He was saying, okay, the war is over now. The Americans are gone. The country is united. Now, let's have airfare. No, let's when do direct flights begin to San Francisco so I can go back? I mean, that's basically how we felt. And this really, really upset the old line Politburo in Hanoi. So the first thing they did was they sent him away for a year and to a political institute where he had to be deprogrammed and taught to think like a communist. He failed. You know, he failed the classes, and they sent him back, and they told him to teach them that the one thing he was good at was teaching the media, so he would teach journalists, communist journalists, how to be journalists. And he left, saying, if I did that, everyone will lose their red card. And basically then he was put under house arrest from 1976 until 1984, 1985, just as the opening with the West began under Du Moy. And then, of course, things got better, but he was never allowed to leave the country, ever, because they didn't trust him until the very end. They still didn't know who he really was. And he always said, and the book's full of these quotes, I didn't fight this revolution for this. You know, these people are... And he would go on and on, and it's well documented in the book, and I think he would agree with her very much.
It's astounding. We have a caller on the cell phone. You're on the line with Larry Berman.
Hi there. Thank you very much for having the show. It's very interesting material. I have a comment which perhaps you could reply to, and that is the rhetoric of war. Actually, the word war and conflating that with the occupation of Vietnam, I think is one of the problems with repeating those same mistakes in another place, namely Iraq, in another occupation. Neither one of the attacks on these countries did Congress ever declare war, and I'm curious as to why, especially someone who's educated and done a great deal of research on Vietnam occupation, would want to call it a war. And that's all I've got. I'll hang up and listen.
Good question.
Well, of course, in Vietnam they call it the American War, and we call it the Vietnam War. But and I really think it should be called the War Between the Vietnamese. But of course, Lyndon Johnson didn't, to answer your question specifically, Lyndon Johnson did not want to call it a war, and that's why he soft-sold it, and that's why he allowed these troops to be roll in using the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution as his main legal authorization for the war, until that was repealed much later. But no one really ever wanted to call it a war, precisely for that reason.
You know, Larry, I can imagine that there are a lot of South Vietnamese who might view An as a traitor to their now defunct nation. You know, and I wonder what kind of response to the book you've received from former South Vietnamese military political leaders, or from those who fled Vietnam as boat people in the 70s and 80s.
Yeah, well, I'm getting a mixed response. I've had big book signings and book events in Westminster, California, the heart of the overseas Vietnamese population. More Vietnamese live in Orange County today than anywhere else in the United States, and it's quite mixed. Amongst a significant group of people, there is hatred and anger for An for being this kind of spy and for contributing to the destruction of their country. The end of what we would know as the Republic of Vietnam. But amongst others, there is a view that they understand An as a nationalist. He was not part of the, at the end of the war, this sort of Hanoi syndrome. That is, he never once spoke of with victor's arrogance or anything like that. There's, you know, people tend to view him with much more sympathy. What is interesting is that there is two Vietnamese language editions of this book coming out, one being published in Vietnam, a legal translation that is being published in Vietnam that will be released next week, but also a Vietnamese language edition being published in Westminster by Nguyen Viet, which is a overseas, which is basically a newspaper representing the views of those Vietnamese who have left Vietnam.
Well, Larry, thank you very, very much for joining. Our guest today has been Larry Berman, author of Perfect Spy, The Incredible Double Life of Pham Xuan An, Time Magazine reporter and Vietnamese communist agent. Larry, once again, thank you for spending this time with us today, and I really encourage our listeners, if you've not had a chance to read this book, go pick it up. It's really a fascinating read. And once again, thank you very much, Larry, and good luck with the book and the book tour that you're on.
I appreciate it. Thank you.